Support for Today Explained comes from BetterHelp. We'd all like to find an extra hour every day for the things that really matter. Therapy might be able to help you suss out what is most important and prioritize it. And BetterHelp can make the entire process convenient and painless. You can fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist in practically no time at all. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. You can visit betterhelp.com/explain today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/explained.
Over two-thirds of Earth's surface is ocean.
I'll tell you, if there ever was a fragile, appearing piece of blue in space, it's the Earth right now.
But back when our planet first formed, it was incredibly hot, like way too hot for liquid water to condense.
So it's always been a bit of a problem, is how do you get so much water onto Earth?
This week on Unexplainable, where'd all this water come from? Follow Unexplainable for new episodes every Wednesday.
My name's Nicholas Niarchos, and I'm a freelance journalist based in New York. In 2014, a man started digging a hole in his backyard. He was digging a new toilet pit. And he was surprised when his shovel struck a brightly colored rock. People in that area that he lived, which was the suburb of Kasulo in the Southern Democratic Republic of the Congo, always talked about the richness below the soil. They talked about rich copper and cobalt mines that were situated near the town. And in the rainy season, sometimes the soil would go green with the mineral deposits. So he discovered a seam of cobalt, which is a mineral that is used in electric car batteries, cell phone batteries, computer batteries, lithium ion batteries. And cobalt has gone through this kind of boom in the last 2 decades, basically, because of the demand for these batteries. So he chipped away some cobalt, took it to a local trader, and the local trader said, yes, this is worth something, actually. This is very good quality. The man came back, started digging out the cobalt himself. Then he started hiring people to go down into these holes that he'd dug into his kitchen. And very soon his neighbors noticed unusual activities. They heard the sort of telltale sounds of clanging at night. And they saw people bringing out sacks of ore, and they said, this person is exploiting his own parcel. Actually, he was renting. When his landlord investigated, the guy fled. The rest of the residents of the town sort of said, we're sitting on a gold mine here, and started digging down. There was this amazing story of a church in which the pastor and the congregation began digging into the floor of the church, stopping only for Sunday services. The mayor came out and said, listen, you can't do this. The governor came out and said, listen, you can't do this. And the people said, listen, this is our soil. We want to exploit it. And at one point, they began sort of stoning local officials. So the exploitation of these rich seams of cobalt continued. So the town of Kasulo became completely unstable, and a local road was destabilized, in fact. And it was when that collapsed, the governor said, we've got to do something about this problem. Long story short, the governor, he went to a Chinese firm, and his family had business dealings with that firm, and that Chinese firm acquired the right to buy cobalt off miners in that parcel. So they walled off the parcel. The town was completely leveled. They removed the topsoil and they blasted down into the ground. And then they basically allowed miners to go in and start digging in the ground. And the people who were displaced were given a couple of $1,000 or a new home in this development called Semukinda, which I actually visited. There's really very little there. There's no school. And so they were shown these houses, which looked beautiful in brochures. But in fact, when they arrived, they realized they were very, very poorly constructed. They leaked. The well in front of the houses didn't work. There was no water. The bathrooms didn't work, and so on. So it's really a desperate situation for the people who live out there. And many of the people actually just left their new homes and went in search of a better life elsewhere.
Nicholas, you wrote about what happened to Kasulo in an article for The New Yorker about the dark underbelly of cobalt mining in Congo. Cobalt prices are booming right now because they're needed for smartphone batteries, for electric car batteries. What puts Congo at the center of that boom?
So Congo sits atop 3.4 million tons of cobalt, and it's the largest proven reserve of the mineral worldwide. What's more, the cobalt is very close to the surface, so it's very easy to mine compared to other areas where it's much deeper.
About 70% of the world's cobalt comes from the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
So it is what some officials there like to call, quote unquote, the Saudi Arabia of cobalt, referring to Saudi Arabia's rich oil deposits.
Which is to say sort of that this new energy era will be about cobalt, not gas.
I don't think the new energy era is necessarily simply about cobalt, but it is about battery minerals, including cobalt. And cobalt is at the moment key for batteries. It stops them overheating and allows smaller battery sizes to be made. As long as that is a necessity, cobalt will be a key strategic mineral.
And the fact that it's a key strategic mineral is complicated by the politics of the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
Yes, the strategy is complicated by the extraordinarily complex politics of Congo, which arise out of the ashes of a very violent colonization by the Belgians, a very corrupt dictatorship run by a U.S. ally, Mobutu Sese Seko, who was the dictator who ruled from the 60s all the way until the 90s. And basically stripped the country bare along with his cronies and became incredibly wealthy as a result.
Which is to say that this thirst for cobalt isn't the first time a foreign power has come into Congo to extract a very valuable resource.
Absolutely not, no. So the Belgians came and extracted first rubber, which was known as red rubber, because they were so violent in their means of extracting it.
Leopold wanted some part of the world where he could reign supreme and where he could make a lot of money.
Famously, Adam Hochschild, who is the author of King Leopold's Ghost, estimates that up to 10 million Congolese died as the result of that colonial extraction.
10 million?
10 million people, which is, Holocaust figure of people killed.
Basically, his soldiers would go into village after village, would hold the women hostage in order to force the men of each village to go deep into the rainforest for days and eventually weeks out of each month and gather a monthly quota of wild rubber. And you can actually see photographs of these women hostages in chains.
At the beginning of the 20th century, it became a direct colony under Belgium, and conditions did improve. But, they shifted away from extracting ivory and rubber because there were other sources of rubber in the world and it wasn't quite as valuable. So they started looking at other deposits around Congo, and Congo is very rich in diamonds, it's very rich in copper, it's very rich in cobalt, it's very rich in gold, it's very rich in this mineral called coltan, which is used in electric capacitors, to the extent that when the PlayStation 2 came out, which was a very coltan-intensive device, this was in the late 90s, during a period where Congo was really in a heavy civil war.
Troops loyal to President Laurent Kabila, backed by their Zimbabwean and Angolan allies, grimly defend the airport northeast of Kinshasa, fighting off a determined but apparently unsuccessful offensive by rebel forces.
It kind of fueled this civil war in what became known as, quote-unquote, the PlayStation War, which is pretty depressing.
So bringing us back to this current moment, you've got this country that suffered decades of bloody colonialism and dictatorship and war. Now it's sort of a democracy, though a corrupt and problematic one, that's experiencing this cobalt boom. What does it mean for Congo?
the cobalt boom for Congo is not necessarily a sort of unrestrained good for the country. You know, when suddenly a rush for raw materials occurs in that sort of context, you see a lot of the wealth diverted away from the population. On the ground, what you see is a huge level of migration to the areas in which copper and cobalt is found. Both of these minerals are used in this new sort of technological world, and people sort of have rushed to mine it, and that's created a great deal of pressure on the local infrastructure.
And you told us the story of Kasulo, but what is this industry like more broadly? Surely individual people are not providing the entire world's cobalt supply.
Yeah, certainly not. The majority of cobalt is mined by large companies, mainly Chinese at this point. So it's anything from 10 to 30% is mined by artisanal miners, and the rest is mined by industrial miners, they're called.
And artisanal mining is what exactly?
So artisanal mining is basically people going down holes that have been dug in the ground, and they will chip away at a rock face, literally people going down with metal bars to chip away at the rock face down in the hole and bring up minerals that they sell at a sort of marketplace. They sell to traders, often foreign traders.
After they fill their bags with the cobalt, they sell the merchandise on the black market, which is controlled by Chinese companies.
Like it's kind of anarchic was the word that the governor used.
When we offered to sell a truckload of cobalt, nobody asked us who mined the mineral, only what the quality was. This man told us that the Chinese traders here bought all the cobalt and sold it mainly to one Chinese company, Congo Dongfang Mining, known locally as CDM.
Artisanal miners are, to some extent, regulated. There's also a body called SIMAPE, which provides them training, but in practice, most of the artisanal mines that I saw really followed very few safety regulations, to the extent that many of the miners didn't have shoes. They certainly weren't wearing safety helmets.
They have no protective equipment and few tools, just a couple of shovels. And they're doing this knowing their previous three tunnels have collapsed.
It seemed as if they were going down these pits hundreds of feet deep with only the most rudimentary of tools. By that I mean half a crowbar and a little plastic torch strapped to their head.
And there's been some controversy in recent years that some of these artisanal miners can be kids, right?
Because of the lack of governance, it's very difficult to make a full study of children mining in artisanal mines. But some of these artisanal miners are definitely kids. I spoke to many children who had left the mining profession, and the range of ages for children working in these mines is quite staggering. I spoke to children who said that they started working in the mines as young as three, you know, picking through rejected minerals to see if there was anything that had been rejected that was of value.
3 years old.
Yeah, so they're taught to learn the differences between minerals at a very young age. Often it happens a little bit later. That's a very extreme example. And as the boys, because it's mainly boys who are doing this work, become older and stronger, they're actually sent down the mines themselves, which are incredibly dangerous, incredibly airless, and the material that they're mining is actually kind of toxic in itself. Girls will also do this kind of work, but mainly outside of the mines themselves, outside of the pits, and they will, you know, be washing ore. Their mothers will be washing ore. It's a sight that you see on the side of the street. You're driving down the road and you see children going down to a little creek and sort of bringing down bags of minerals and washing them and then giving them to men on motorbikes who will speed off to go and sell it at the market.
So you have these miners selling ore to traders or a Chinese company. They don't have safety equipment and they sometimes don't even have shoes. You have kids working in this industry. And on top of all of that, the mining itself is pretty dangerous.
The act of mining cobalt is particularly dangerous because the soil is fairly unstable and there are all kinds of stories of cave-ins. In any one cave-in, you know, 70, 100 miners can perish, especially if they're working in a kind of illegal fashion. So there are a lot of miners who will sneak onto industrial concessions at night, bribing police or soldiers who are supposed to be guarding the concessions. And they'll, be chipping away in the middle of the night, and suddenly there'll be a landslide.
I don't want to dance around this. Is there a chance that someone driving a Tesla or, you know, who just bought an iPhone 13 Pro Plus or whatever it's called could be using a device that has cobalt that was mined by a shoeless child with half a crowbar and a plastic flashlight attached to his head in Congo?
Absolutely, absolutely. But remember that the laptops that we're using to converse now, and probably the Samsung that I'm holding to my head, yes, there's a chance that all of those devices might have Congolese cobalt mined in those situations in the battery. And it's funny, when you go down there, and I replaced my phone this spring, and I, before having reported this piece, you know, I would think of it as an annoyance, it would be an expense and so on, but I didn't think of it as a waste. But there's something kind of incredibly affecting about seeing the conditions in which some of these batteries are made. What I will say is that Apple and Tesla have both made efforts to clean up their supply chain, and other companies as well need to look at their supply chain in order to make sure that this is a type of activity that is not supported at all by the world's demand for cobalt and demand for lithium-ion batteries. I approached a child named Zicky who had just gotten out of artisanal mining. And he was sort of talking to me about his terrible experience, how he had started mining at age 3, how he had gone through all these awful experiences. And I said to him, listen, my cell phone, you know, there's a new model of these cell phones that goes for more than $1,000. And he just kind of looked at it with this kind of great sadness. And he says, wow, you know, that just makes me feel terrible.
What to do about this cobalt predicament the world is in after an intermission here on Today Explained.
Support for Today Explained comes from Indeed. Indeed wants to help you find the perfect employee, professional yet relaxed, punctual, meets deadlines, makes your job easier, and also hireable. Indeed is a matching and hiring platform with a matching engine built to help you find quality candidates fast. According to a recent Indeed survey, 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. Indeed says they leverage over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, so their matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. And all of that can help you connect with your perfect employee. Listeners of this show can get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Today Explained. You can just go to Indeed.com/Today Explained right now and say you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Today Explained. Terms and conditions do apply. Need to hire? You may need Indeed.
Support for the show comes from NetSuite. There are a lot of things in life that give you headaches, like seats on an airplane with no legroom. That makes all sorts of parts of my body ache. Or having to pay $10 for a bottle of water at an amusement park. Don't do it, folks. Bring your own. Or just the existence of the DMV. Burn. DMV burn. There's got to be a good DMV out there. Anyway, NetSuite isn't like that. They actually want to help your business by making things simpler. NetSuite is a top-rated cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. That's where they get me personally. According to NetSuite, you can reduce IT costs because it lives in the cloud with no hardware required. Access it from everywhere, anywhere. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. You can head to netsuite.com/explained, netsuite.com/explained.
netsuite.com/explained.
Nicholas, I think we kind of understand the artisanal mining side of the picture now, but tell me more about the big companies here. What's the industry look like in its, you know, biggest form?
So the mining industry in its biggest form is a multinational industry in which large, you know, companies extract minerals from the ground and buy and sell them on the international market. And as you can imagine, these companies are incredibly wealthy. They're incredibly well provisioned, and they have mine sites that reflect that.
We are receiving the ore coming underground, open pit, and after that we mill them, we grind them, and we mix with all of the chemical to float and to get a good concentrate.
A lot of those mines are now controlled by Chinese companies, whether it's as investors or as direct control through Chinese companies.
And that hasn't always been the case.
That hasn't always been the case. So after the Belgians left Congo, they continued to be very much involved in the mining industry. And Europeans were basically designated to run the mines for President Mobutu. But after a series of rebel attacks and mismanagement, the mines began to be run more by people from the country. And the mines also, just before the Civil War and then during the Civil War, kind of started falling into disrepair. So the mines were sort of left fallow for a long time during the Civil War, which lasted from 1997 until, you know, the mid-2000s. At that point, Western and other foreign mining companies started casting around for access to Congo's rich mineral deposits, and they began extracting copper and cobalt in the wake of the Civil War, and that was able to fuel the government and fuel the ruling party as it sought to monopolize its hold on power.
So at what point does the West move out and China move in?
The Chinese started moving in the late aughts.
Back in 2008, the Democratic Republic of Congo struck a big deal with Beijing. China's state-owned firms would build hospitals and roads in return for revenues from copper and cobalt mines.
And they would essentially buy the mines directly off these companies, and they would work in partnership with the state-owned mining company, which is known as Gécamines, in order to acquire these mines.
In the Congo, China has secured a considerable stake. It will receive 68% of mining revenue. The Congolese government's share is 32%.
I think that there is a certain amount of risk involved with doing business in DRC, and a lot of Western companies, especially as the oversight increased and as more journalism and investigative work began to be done around these issues of corruption and so on, said, listen, we're going to wash our hands of this and sort of get away.
And what do Chinese mining operations in Congo look like?
Chinese mining operations in Congo, I mean, the big industrial mines would look like probably mines anywhere else in the world. There's been some sort of questioning of safety standards, but broadly, I mean, the big industrial mining outfits, and I don't want to speak about all of them, but I did visit one in the south of Congo, and it appeared very well run and a sort of very professional seeming place. However, there are the Chinese artisanal mining outfits, which do not resemble that at all in any way, shape, or form. I mean, those resemble, you know, something from a different period. You know, you see shoeless people, and you see people being beaten savagely and by sort of overseers, and you see kind of all kinds of terrible things. I think there is a sense that there's like a sort of new form of colonialism going on by the Chinese, and there are definitely examples and videos that I've been shown of Chinese overseers mistreating Congolese workers. But at the same time, you have to admit that these large industrial enterprises are run as large industrial enterprises in the 21st century.
And how much are these large industrial enterprises serving the country? How much are they elevating the nation and the Congolese people?
It's very difficult to tell what benefits the Congolese people, because money is certainly paid back into the Congolese economy, but because of issues around corruption, a lot of that money doesn't actually reach the people, and it probably ends up in bank accounts in different parts of the world that are controlled by local politicians.
So despite, you know, decades of foreign mining operations, that certainly fed hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars into the Congolese economy, I'm guessing you don't see a lot of electric cars rolling around in Congo.
You certainly don't see electric cars rolling around in Congo.
Is there a world in which, you know, Congo could integrate more of this cobalt economy and, I don't know, you know, start building electric cars, start building iPhones? Or is all of that manufacturing happening in the West or in China itself?
All of that manufacturing is happening in the West or in China or in abroad, basically. Ironically, one of Congo's issues is that it doesn't have a steady stream of electricity, and it's very difficult for businesses, especially these kind of high-tech businesses, to set up if they can't be assured of power 24/7, even though this is the country that produces the raw materials which go into batteries. So there are systemic issues that need to be dealt with before Congo can become a high-tech producer. But in the end of the day, I mean, you have to think that it's better to be doing this on the country's soil than shipping all this mineral halfway around the world and then, you know, putting it into the back of a phone and then shipping it halfway around the world again and tweaking it a little bit and then selling it, you know, hundreds of miles away. I mean, I think that is a very wasteful way of looking at things beyond any issues of like corruption and local gain. And then it's also a way in which people there are kind of left out of this boom.
So what's the caring consumer supposed to do? The person who buys an electric car because they think they're doing the environment a favor, or, you know, gets the newest iPhone because it's revolutionizing their lives and making everything easier. And at the same time, maybe just right now, listening to this interview, discovering that the products that help their devices work are coming from this, in some cases, incredibly painful, dangerous, abusive system, or in other cases, this incredibly dangerous, corrupt system. I mean, should we be hoping for cobalt alternatives, or should we be hoping that, you know, the Congolese government gets its act together?
Well, yes, there are battery scientists working on cobalt alternatives. That is true. The current options around batteries for electric cars don't have the range or the acceleration capabilities of a cobalt battery. And the current optionality for cell phones would require the batteries to be much larger and would require the phones to be larger as a result. So, I mean, either I suppose we could accept larger phones and slower cars, or, you know, we can try and hold these companies to account to show that these issues actually mean things to a consumer. And at the same time, I think also reducing one's sort of personal waste and trying, you know, maybe if one doesn't need that new computer or one doesn't need that new iPhone, not replacing it and trying to kind of slow one's impact on that cycle.
It kind of just feels like one of those stories where there's no good solution.
There are good solutions. I mean, I think there's certainly a solution by which the people of Congo are remunerated in an acceptable way. There's a solution in which transparency is brought to Congo and accountability. It doesn't need to be this brutal. It doesn't need to be an industry that just takes away and doesn't give. But at the moment, the way in which it is set up and the way in which it is developing, because all this stuff is accelerating as well, is incredibly brutal and, you know, creates these situations and these cycles of poverty and exclusion and ultimately sort of human rights abuses.
Reporter Nicholas Niarchos wrote about the cobalt industry in the Congo for The New Yorker. His story is titled The Dark Side of Congo's Cobalt Rush, and you can find it at newyorker.com. Our show today was produced by Will Reed, edited by Matthew Collette, engineered by Afim Shapiro, and fact-checked by Laura Bullard. I'm Sean Ramos-Firm, and this is Today Explained.